Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Hey everyone, welcome to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and we are excited to talk about testimony and the act of testimony bearing, or the ritual of fasting and testifying one Sunday each month, and all the sorts of different pieces and feelings and thoughts about that. It seems like it's a topic that comes up quite a bit on online discussion groups in the Bloggernacle and the various communities that we're all part of, and I just think it's worth doing, and I'm really grateful for a blog post that came in a few days ago by one of our guests, Brent Beal, and we'll talk with him and get kind of the framing that he gave to fast and testimony. So I it's a good subject to do, but Brent is definitely the impetus for us doing it right now. So thank you, Brent, on that.
Thanks, Dan.
Let me go ahead and introduce the three of you, and so maybe, Brent, we'll just start with you. If you don't mind reintroducing yourself to everyone, Brent, for those of you who listened to the one on immigration, was one of our panelists there, and he is also married to Heather Olson Beal, and Heather has been on the podcast a few times as well. So, Brent, if you want to take it away with at least a bit more general background.
Sure. My wife started a blog, and I joined her about a month and a half ago, and I don't really consider myself a blogger, but I started putting up a kind of a series of posts. I called them "A Mormon in the Cheap Seats" is what I write under. So I've been having fun with that. I'm a business professor. I work up at UT Tyler here in East Texas. And what more do you want to know? Is that enough?
That's good for now, and we'll certainly allow any autobiography that comes out in the course of it to fill that out. So thank you.
Okay.
Brian Johnston, would you reintroduce yourself to our listeners? You've been on the podcast, was it just once so far?
Yeah, I think just once so far.
Yeah, now
so.
You were also interviewed full on, got the full John DeLynn treatment on Mormon Stories. So and then you did the Jared Anderson interview, right?
Right, yeah.
And that was, for those of you who can listen, that was a few months ago, and that was on the New Testament thing. So Brian was the driving factor behind that. But Brian, tell us more about your life.
What else do I do? I run one of the people that runs stayLDS.com. So that's a site I'm involved in a lot. I participate in a lot of different places on, you know, Facebook groups, New Order Mormon sometimes. I get involved in the Open Stories Foundation stuff occasionally too. What else? I live with my family here in the Washington, D.C. area. That's about all I can think about right now.
Sounds good. Thank you so much. And we're grateful, everyone, to have back one of our favorite panelists, and that is Jana Reese. Jana, would you reintroduce yourself to our folks?
Well, Dan, hello. I'm very glad to be here, and I'm a blogger at flunkingsainthoodforbeliefnet.com and also an author. My forthcoming book is Flunking Sainthood, which will be out in November.
Cool. And your background, do you remind people of your background? I know that you kind of talked a lot about it during the one on Christianity and are Mormons Christian or why are they considered dangerous by some groups and things like that. Would you mind, you know, giving a little more of your spiritual autobiography?
Okay, I will try to do that very
well. Quickly. And the reason I'm thinking of is because the testimony piece kind of fills, you know, you bring certain perspectives to it. So that'd be
well, for the church, which certainly does make a difference. I didn't grow up hearing formulaic testimonies or testimonies of any kind, really, except I remember my father testifying to me that Ayn Rand was true. Yes.
John Galt has the truth, right?
That's anyway, so I converted to Protestantism when I was 14 and then to Mormonism when I was 23 and in seminary, which is not the typical path necessarily for most Mormon converts, but that was mine.
Yes, it was. And then for years, you were the religion book editor at Publishers Weekly.
That's right.
Right. And I didn't mean to make your biography longer than these other guys. Sorry. Let's dive in. The topic is testimony, guys. And Brent, why don't we start with just, let's just go with kind of the insights and the experiences that drove your post. So if you don't mind just telling us the basic thought pattern that, or the basic argument of your post and how it went.
The post on doves and serpents, right?
Right. The Mormon and the cheap seats post that.
Sure. It's really a kind of a two-parter. I wrote, I try to keep it to about 500 words, 800 words, and sometimes it gets away from me. And so I started a post. It was called Build Out, Not Up. And my idea there was just to kind of get at this idea of spiritual knowledge as building blocks. And, you know, are they the kind of blocks that you can use to, you know, build a tower, so to speak? I mean, that was kind of the metaphor I was using. And what I argued in that post was that these kind of blocks are pretty pretty idiosyncratic. They're a little fuzzy in places. They're not the kind of things that you want to stack. And so I kind of played with that metaphor a little bit and argued that, you know, it's better to build out. We shouldn't be trying to build these spiritual towers.
Because like a Jenga, you could pull something down low and it would all tumble, right?
Right, yeah, right. Yeah. And so, you know, this idea that we can build this tower, you know, maybe a better metaphor in the church, one that we use all the time, is that our testimonies are like plants. You know, we want to water them and then they're going to grow over time. And they're going to become larger and more imposing. And I suppose the idea there is that we're going to reach at some point a degree of certainty that we're, you know, we're going to take this faith that we have and we're going to stack our blocks until they get high enough that we don't need the faith anymore. You know, we're going to be absolutely certain of what we know to be true. And so I just kind of took that and played with it a little bit in that initial post. And then at the end of that post, I thought, well, you know, the obvious place to kind of go next with this in the next post is Fast and Testimony Meeting, because that's where, you know, the rubber kind of meets the road. I started out that post by saying that I really like Fast and Testimony Meeting. It's this place where we can go and listen to other adults, and there aren't very many forums for this, but listen to other adults talk about their most intimate kind of spiritual feelings and thoughts. It is something that we should take a little reverence to, although I'm sure we've all got a few funny stories we can tell. In that meeting, I think it's just interesting to me to take apart those testimonies and kind of follow the logic that goes on. You know, how do we build these testimonies? You know, we start from context and then we relate an experience and then we explain that experience and then we draw these broad conclusions, kind of a four-step process.
And the conclusion at the end is usually what? Therefore, the church is true. Yeah. Yes. Okay,
well, cool. Absolutely. And it's the conclusion that the church tries to constrain. And I'm sure we'll get into this. I mean, that's why we have things like the testimony glove and the talk by Dallin H. Oakes, where, you know, we're told exactly what the conclusion is supposed to be. But what I find is that what's most valuable to me is the front part. It's the human experience. You know, it's what people think and what they do and what they feel. And I'm not always in agreement with the explanation they provide for it, or for the conclusions they reach. But nonetheless, the front part of that can be pretty valuable. So that's the point I tried to make. Hopefully, I didn't take too long kind of going through that.
No, and either the other two of you who've read that, is there any thing in there that you'd like to echo, or that you found it particularly intriguing that might lead to a good launch?
Actually, while Brent was saying that about building the blocks, and this is just an odd thought, but I thought you keep building blocks higher and higher, sounded all of a sudden a lot like the Tower of Babel, you know, and trying to reach God sort of thing. But the higher you go, the more delicate it can be, could just get toppled over sort of thing. Or I don't know, maybe I'm thinking too much along the lines of like mythic stories and what kind of meaning you can draw out of that whole thing.
No, I think that works a lot. Jana, any thoughts off of Brent's thing as a launching point, or I can start steering us down other areas?
Well, I very much liked this post, and I think that Brent and I are kind of kindred spirits in how we approach Fast and Testimony meeting. It's actually my favorite Sunday of the month, despite the fact that fasting is hard, and we can certainly talk about that later. But I love testimony meeting because it's, as he says, Mormonism's very own reality show. I thought that was great.
That's right. I'd forgotten that line.
And I'd like to ask Brent, actually, he talks about the testimony glove. Okay, now I've never heard that before. And again, not having grown up in the church, what the heck is a testimony glove?
Oh, Jana,
you're missing out.
It's only about 2 years old, so it hasn't been around that long. But go ahead. You want to give a quick shot on it, Brent?
Me? Well, probably the best thing to do is just to click on the link out of the dozenserpents.com post. But it actually is, it's a glove, and it's for use, I guess it's to be used in primary. I mean, that's the intention. It comes from a book that was written by Kristen Oakes, I think, which might explain why it got published. I hope that's part of the explanation anyway. But each of the fingers is something you're supposed to testify of. So you have the prophet on one finger and the temple on another and Joseph Smith on another finger, maybe Christ and living, I can't, yeah.
Maybe Christ? And maybe Christ? Oh,
if we're lucky.
But Jana, the idea is that, like, in they might make a glove like this in primary, and the kids would put a picture of Jesus and a picture of Joseph Smith and a picture of the temple and Thomas Monson on the little finger, and that's when they bear their testimony. They can, like, imagine this glove, and it'll tell them what to testify of.
Or they can take the glove right up there to the pulpit with them and just...
Show it.
You know, and I got a kick out of the link I posted there to the friend. Down below it gives some helpful hints, and it says, you know, these are the things you should testify of, and then it says, and here are some words you might want to use. You might want to use, you know, I testify or I know. I mean, it's actually a script at the bottom, which is just fascinating on so many levels. So that's the testimony glove.
Yeah, and we could talk about that in children's testimonies in a minute. But one of the other things about the testimony glove too, Jana, was it was really, was it in the article in The Friend that you were talking about, or at least in some of the material around it, is so many children are getting up there and saying how much they love their families, et cetera, and things like that, and these are not the things that they should be doing, which is like,
right.
That's
right.
It was like it was an extra layer of, you know, you're doing something wrong, here's the only right way to do it, so...
Exactly. Yeah, you want to constrain those explanations and conclusions. You just can't have people up there flying by the seat of their pants.
So that's testimony glove, Jana. How you feel?
I'm a little concerned.
Yeah. Okay. Well, should we use the moment that we're at right now here? Because, Brent, there is some things in your piece that I want to go on to about, you know, like how the first two parts of your four-part, you know, context and experience versus the latter part. So we'll get into that later, but maybe let's talk about something, because this is something that occasionally comes up in the blogs, that people are frustrated with children up there claiming to, quote-unquote, know the church is true, or to know that so-and-so is a prophet, etc. What's your experience, the three of you, all four of us actually are active in the church. We probably have a pretty good sense of the type of knowledge that they're talking about, and yet it's not the standard know, K-N-O-W, that somebody who's a scientist might say, I know about this or that or the other. How do you guys react to children bearing their testimonies and using language like that? And then we can kind of go a little deeper on what Brent just mentioned about the testimony glove stuff.
I'll be happy to jump in. Brian, you want to go first?
Well, I was just going to say, I totally get where people are coming from. It, on some level, I mean, you know, I'm obviously used to seeing it. I grew up in the church, you know. There's always on a, you know, fast and testimony meeting, there's always a couple of kids that go up and do that whole sort of thing. Although, if I'm not mistaken, I think the church has kind of been discouraging that, especially if it's kids that can't go up and do it on their own. You know, they end up having a sibling going up, and the older sibling's whispering in their ear, like, okay, now say this. You know, you know, I think they're starting to discourage that, but, you know, there's still some kids that go up. But I understand the frustration, but on the other hand, I don't know, I wrote down some different types of testimonies, and I call that a belong to Moni. And what I mean by that is
nice.
It's sort of like there's some people that will go up and they'll say sort of, you know, that script thing we've been talking about. You know, it's just a standard four or five things, and then they just, you know, in the name of Jesus Christ, amen. You know, then they take off. And but, you know, in a way, what they're really kind of, at least this is how I process it when I'm listening to that, is they're saying, I belong to the community here. You know, it's sort of almost like reciting a creed almost. It's not really, but, you know, but there's like, I'm saying the same thing that you're saying, and we all believe the same thing. So we're all, I belong. And it's sort of like, you know, your public declaration that I'm part of this group.
Good. And is there anything fundamentally wrong with that in your estimation?
No, but I think what it is, I think a lot of the tension or dissonance, and I felt that at times too, is differences in perspective. And I don't know if we really want to dive into that at the moment, but I just made some notes on that. But I think it's that.
Can I add real quick mm-hmm. something to what you just said, Brian?
Sure.
I liked what you said. I agree. I think it's also, if I can just add this, you know, it is kind of a script, and what you are saying, I think, is, well, hey, I'm part of this group. But I think there is kind of an underlying assumption of shared experience there, too. I think, at least this is the interpretation I put on it, I think when somebody stands up and says, you know, something like, I know, or I testify of this or that, they're saying, hey, I've had a spiritual experience, and sure, the conclusion I'm drawing from that experience is that the church is true, but they're also communicating the fact that they're feeling or have felt or experienced something similar to what everyone else there has felt too, which is just another way to kind of tie themselves into the group.
Good. Jenna, thoughts that come up for you when you see children participating in this activity?
You know, my basic thought is that I love it. I think it's fantastic. This is something that's unique to Mormonism, and it's a special blessing that we offer to our children in the church. Certainly, yes, maybe some of those testimonies sound the same, but I think we need to remember that we grow into testimonies like we grow into clothes. It's something that we live into as we say the words. And I was reminded as I was thinking about this, of this part in the book of Exodus, when the Ten Commandments are given, the people are said, they say, all that you have said, we will do and hear. And so for centuries, there's been this, you know, rabbinic argument, why is it do and hear rather than hear and do? Is that just a mistake? Is it intentional? And some rabbis have said that it is intentional, that in fact we don't live into it until we've already done it. I think that something about Mormon testifying is very resonant with that idea from the book of Exodus. We take a leap of action before we take the leap of thought. And it's not always wise. Sometimes it's formulaic and sometimes it means nothing. But sometimes there's a lot behind that formula.
Excellent. That's really insightful. One of the things that strikes me too is, you know, obviously the fast testimony meaning is a ritual. It's very clearly set up that these are, you know, you begin at a certain time, you end at 5 after the hour or whatever it would be, and you have X amount of time, and during this thing, here are the expectations. And large percentage of the world's rituals, ritual types, are scripted, and it's somewhat important. And in many ways, you know, it helps you get moving into the ritual itself to have some standard entry points and some standard pieces that you pick on. And then hopefully, like you say, Jana, you're taking those basic areas and then you're sharing your experience as you grow into a deeper reflection on those and things like that. And so the fact that the kids are up there, even if it's a testimony glove that helps them remember some of that, I'm not overly thrown by it either.
I just a couple things come to mind. Well, I don't have any problem with the kids going up there. I enjoy it. They're cute. They're endearing. You know, it's a good experience for them. So I guess I don't object to that. And I have, you know, I am aware that some people do kind of look at that as maybe some inappropriate kind of programming that goes on. But I personally don't have a problem with it. There are a couple things that I have reservations about, though, and maybe this will be addressed a little bit later when we get into some larger issues. it's this link that we make between the religious experience, feeling the spirit. That's our phrase that we use as Mormons, but just spiritual experiences in general, I think, is what we're talking about. It's the link between those experiences and the conclusion that the church is therefore true, or elements of the church are therefore true. And there's so much. Sometimes I think the church is almost it functions as kind of a funnel, if nothing else. I mean, we just kind of drill this in from day one, that if you have these feelings, then here is the conclusion that you're supposed to reach. Here's your testimony glove. And so when a child goes up and says, I know the church is true, then, I think they probably felt good about that in primary. They may have had a kind of a sweet spiritual experience, particularly as kids get older. I think that's true. They look for those kinds of experiences. They'll go on a temple trip, or, they'll have a moving kind of moment in a class, and they'll feel those feelings. And so then they'll immediately connect that with these conclusions. And I'm not sure that's entirely healthy. I think we do a little bit too much of that. I think there's some problems with that. And so when I back up and I look at it from a little more of a distance, it does make me a little uneasy how tightly we make that link.
And are you upset even for a 6 to 8 year old to make that tight link, or to have that link presented so tightly? And do you sense that it's held that tightly? Well, I'm guessing you're saying it's held too tightly into adulthood.
Well, yeah,
as well, but
absolutely. But we start early, and then that link is. The church tries to make that link as solid as possible.
So is it just as bad when it's in the youth realm as when it's in the adult realm, or is it at some point does it lose its functionality or its positive purpose when it lands in a mature adult who should maybe be loosening that link a bit more? Or I'm just saying, yeah. Is it equally bad all along, or is there something in childhood development theory or something that might say,
kids are cute. I'm a little annoyed, more annoyed sometimes by somebody who's 40 that does it, that should be able to think in broader parameters than a primary song. I mean, there is kind of some growth that's got to take place and some reflection, I would think, but that's just my bias.
I'm with you there, and obviously I was asking kind of a leading question. So right. fire me from the defense.
We're operating in the church, particularly how primary is conducted, with this idea that we have extrapolated, probably wrongly, from the Book of Alma, that, belief, hope comes first. You have the desire to believe, and then belief comes, and then knowledge. And that once you have knowledge, that's the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, and everything's hunky-dory, and there are unicorns. It's just, that's the progression, right? But in my spiritual life, it's actually precisely the opposite. You begin, and if you're lucky enough to have faith as a child, you begin with knowledge, because as a child, you are merely accepting the testimony of others. And that is, a blessing in itself, right? But then you proceed to the desire to believe. You are proceeding then to belief, hopefully. But what we don't do in the church, and what is really damning, is that we're not teaching people to take that passage from Alma seriously and to identify where we are. we're teaching them that it's okay to drive a car, you get the car keys to your testimony the moment you stand up there and you can say, I know this is true, instead of I believe or I hope that this is true. We are, that troubles me.
Excellent.
And maybe we're saying something similar there. I guess I would... it's not so much the phrasing, if somebody says, well, I believe this is true, or I hope this is true. I mean, that's better than saying, I know, at least it's more accurate, I think, in a sense. But sometimes I wonder, can't we just get up and say, I had this really amazing spiritual experience. This is what I was doing. This is a circumstance. This is how I felt. And then leave it there. Do we always have to draw these broad conclusions, which may or may not hold or be logical? Or I guess I resist this idea that we've got to stack the blocks, that we have the spiritual experience, now we know this, and if we know this, then we know this, and if we know this, then we know this, and pretty soon you know, we've reached this plateau of certainty. I guess I resist that a little bit.
And I'd like to add in, I think the problem that a lot of people run into is the type of information that you're talking about. Like if you're talking about a spiritual experience, like saying that I know that Jesus Christ is my Savior, well, that's like a religious concept that on a scientific level is not provable or disprovable. It's a religious experience of say like feeling saved or freed from sin through this concept of Jesus Christ. Well, I think we raise children to say stuff like that, but we also as you become an adult and you kind of ask like, well, what's the transition point? Well, what if you become an adult and you follow that same kind of process to make investment decisions? You know, like I feel really good about investing in this stock, and I know that's going to solve my family's financial problems, and I have this good feeling, just like I know that Jesus Christ is the Savior. So therefore, I can make this broad conclusion that that's the right investment decision for me or something like that. Well, and I think that's where people get burned.
Yeah, you were kind of joking maybe a little bit with that, but Glenn Beck did lay out exactly that process. I mean, in some of the Goldline commercials, I mean, he wanted people to pray, reflect on it, and then get an answer. And if the answer was to invest, to go ahead and make that phone call. I mean, that was serious. I mean, I don't think I'm mischaracterizing that.
No, there you go.
Serious and seriously dangerous, yeah. No, that's a really very, very interesting line of there. And I do think that's one of the areas that comes up, I think, a lot on these Bloggernacle kind of conversations. It's that equation of this feeling with that, and therefore it's the spirit, and therefore it's true and all that stuff. So I think you've nailed a big piece of it. Let me play just for a second. I was just reminded, Brent, in your comment of Stephen Carter's profound thinker. He's the editor of Sunstone. We had him on as a guest last week as we talked about the upcoming symposium and sort of the history. But he's also a literary, his PhD is in English, and he's a storyteller and a thinker about how stories are told and whatnot. And he spoke at Sunstone a year or so ago, and it was on the process of writing spiritual autobiography. And he talked about the intensity of an experience. And then he says, for those first hours of after you've had an experience, it's raw and you don't know which way's up and you don't really know what to think about. All you know is that this is intense. And then he says, then you may call your friend and you start to process it with your friend and you're still all over the map as to what it means or whatever. He says, then, within a few days, you've started to settle into sort of a narrative about what this experience means. And he says, then the next month, you're up at Fast and Testimony meeting and you've now nailed the conclusion. And from that point on, that raw, powerful, chaotic experience is now sort of being run by the story that you have put it in there. And it's very, very hard to revisit and to get back into that rawness because you've gone that process of now saying what it means. Are you following me so far? So what you're kind of saying, and so his whole idea was for writing spiritual autobiography is get yourself out of that mode and try to stay in between that second and third phase. Try to stay in when you're writing into that phase of the raw emotion and the way you're sort of processing it with your friend out loud and when you're still only reaching tentative conclusions. He says that's the best place to write your spiritual memoir or to mine for your story. And I think that's really profound. And there's some ways that we do, when we draw the conclusions like you do, we have impoverished the experience.
I totally agree. And another thing that's really interesting to me is that, we go to church and we're taught this this process, this three-step process for determining whether something is true or not, but we don't test that process in any way. I mean, we just take it at face value, it seems. This idea that, we'll go to Moroni's promise, and you can use that promise to test the Book of Mormon, but then you stop to think, well, wait a second, the promise is part of the Book of Mormon that I'm testing. So right. how do I test the test? If I pray about something and I get this feeling, does that mean it's true? Or does it mean eight other things that it might mean, and why do I choose one of those eight meanings to attach to it? And I just kind of add that to what you said, because I think spiritual experiences are pretty raw. They don't come with instructions, and they don't come with a lot of meaning sometimes either.
But it's kind of like what Jana said. You know, when we go in the reverse with the experiment, it's like the truest thing is that I have had this experience.
Absolutely.
And the least true thing is the formulaic words that you've used, you know, which we all recognize will never capture adequately the experience. And yet that seems to be the process. It's the reverse processes that we should really be going, seems to be the way that we do it in the church. Get yourself from raw, powerful, in touch with something huge, and put it in weenie words. Or least powerful words, yeah. So,
just to play on what Jana said a while back, another thing that she kind of alluded to. Jana, if I'm putting words in your mouth, speak up. But you talked about.
I did just now. So I'm sorry.
She talked about kind of growing into testimonies and kind of learning the formula, so to speak. And that's something that's bothered me. A little bit, and I don't know if she meant this or not, but it made me think of the Boyd K. Packer Candle of the Lord talk, where he talks about gaining a testimony by bearing it. This idea that if you're uncertain and you don't really maybe, you know, have any sort of surety about this particular principle, that it's okay to go ahead and bear testimony of that principle, because that's a way of getting a spiritual experience that will confirm that it is in fact true. And this talk was directed toward, I think it was given at a seminar for new mission presidents, so it was you know, targeted to missionaries. But that was something that I was taught on my mission, and that never sat very well with me at all. This idea that you could stand up and say something that you knew was less than true in order to have a spiritual experience that would confirm the truth of something that you didn't know was true. It seems very circular to me.
I agree with you. I think that the danger of, you know, what I was saying before, and anything spiritually taken to whatever extreme, is dangerous on either side. But the danger of that is that you would fake it till you make it, you know, that you think it's acceptable to get up there and be dishonest in your dealings with all your fellow men and basically lie. And I'm sure that there are Latter-day Saints who have done that in testimony meeting, and I hope that people will stop. I think it would be beautiful, and I've done this actually myself, to stand up in testimony meeting and say, I don't know about this, but this is what I'm thinking of, and I hope that this is true. There is such a place for honesty and just being ourselves in testimony meeting. If we cannot be ourselves in church with our brothers and sisters, where can we?
That's a great point.
Yeah, powerful.
You know, Heather... Heather's sitting in the room with me here, so she can defend herself, I guess, if she wants. But she got up, this was a little while back, and gave a very honest kind of testimony. It basically did exactly what you're talking about, Jana. And what was so interesting to me is the reaction that she got after the meeting was over. People came up and just, you know, really, really thanked her for her testimony and really identified with it. In a way that made me stop and think, wow, you know, is this, you know, people want this. I mean, that they want this authenticity sometimes and this honesty, but it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like the emperor with no clothes. I mean, no one wants to admit maybe that this is a little more faith-based than our language would indicate.
I've had that experience too, where you just phrase something differently and people will hear it. And yet you're not being subversive. You're being, like Jana says, you're authentic, and you may not be able to phrase it in a certain way. And yet the response is there because other people are so relieved that, you know, somebody else isn't quite as comfortable with, I know, in that, you know, the way that Mormons often, you know, emphasize, you have to know or else you're just not there.
I want to return for just a moment to that sort of syllogism. I don't remember who brought it up, but the, you know, if God answered my prayer about this small thing in my life, then the whole enchilada is true. You know, I thought that was a very profound point, because I see that all the time in the church, that if one thing is true, then all of it is true. And I think it would be helpful for us to go back and really pay attention to what Alma 32 is saying, because literally it says, your knowledge is perfect in that thing. And that's, those three words are very important, in that thing. We can't extrapolate from our spiritual experience in one area to believe that every single aspect of this doesn't need to be tested.
Awesome. Brian, you've been a little quiet lately. You want to jump in?
Yeah, I agree with what Jana was saying. I think also, though, like, we get hung up a lot of times on this language of knowing and what that means. And I think to some extent it's kind of a problem of our language and also just like Mormon culture having developed this sort of phrase. But I think there are some things that you can know that are these like experiential transcendent things that are really, in some ways, I think of them more as like a deep subconscious feeling that all this stuff is integrated together and good, you know, or I don't know. I'm trying to think of, I've known a couple of people in my life that would say, I know the church is true. And I've had a conversation with them and they don't really know anything about the history of the church. They say, well, I don't really read books and all this stuff, but they know the church is true. But if you start talking to them about their life, like I had a bishop in another ward, and he would share this openly, that he had been raised in a very, very hard family. I think his parents were alcoholics, and at some point, and you know, this is probably back in the 60s, but he had actually been removed from the home and had to live in foster care. He wasn't a member of the church. But at some point, he connected with the church, got married to a nice Mormon girl, has a beautiful family, is, you know, pulled himself out of that wreck, and somewhat successful in business, has a nice life. And to him, the church did that for him. So, like, when somebody like that says, I know the church is true, That's the whole backstory that they're sharing. And that same person was somebody who told me that, like, he doesn't really read books or know anything about the history of the church. And, you know, if you bring up anything controversial, but that's his experiential knowledge. And so I can appreciate it when somebody like that still says something, even though, you know, I want with the semantics to have problems with it, but I know what he's saying. Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. All you have to do is just replace that phrase with, when I hear
I know the church
like that,
is good, or I know the church is functional.
Or I know the church has helped me, or I know the church has you know, been a positive thing for me in my life. I mean, absolutely.
But everything the church promised him came true. I mean, now, that doesn't happen necessarily for everybody, but for him, in his experience, that was
you know, true. And I do think Alma, I think Alma 30, Jana, you brought that up a couple times. The way I interpret that allegory there with the seed and faith kind of transforming into this knowledge of this particular thing, I think that is more behavioral in a sense. I mean, I think what's at least that's my read on it. That's how I like to interpret it. What it's talking about is taking something and testing it, living it, experiencing it, and either it works for you or it doesn't. And if it works for you, then, well, you know it works for you. You know, you don't need to have faith anymore. I mean, you did it, you know, and you can talk about your experience now in a much more concrete way.
Right. And wouldn't you say that if you were to ask somebody afterwards, I remember if you just even got to know them and you were to share with them, I really appreciate your testimony and your knowledge is so good. Tell me more about that knowledge. They will end up telling you it probably at this functional level, right? Rather than the, so in other words, I think we all hear the word know and we forget that there's all these different ways of knowing. And I think that's part of the big hang up that a lot of people have is they're only thinking, you know as in this corresponds with reality. That's the kind of knowledge and truth that they say they're having, and that can't possibly be true. You know, we need to realize that it's true. I know because I know that it's powerful. I know that it transformed me. I know that it makes me feel happy. I know that I have an expansive view of myself because of these things. All those things are encompassed in know, and we always want to make it correspond with reality, correspond with the history of the church as the Sunday school teacher, you know, wants to phrase it. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what you're doing, though, is or what we've done is we're talking about, going back to my post, if I can here for a second, we're on bus stop 2, which is provide some context and then talk about the experience. And there's different ways to do that. You can say, well, I know the church is true, and what that means is I've experienced this part of it, and I know that it's valuable or was valuable for me or worked for me. I contrast that a little bit with, you know, I put that guy, I call him Mr. Testimony Glove, the guy that gets up, and instead of relating something that's experiential or that he's experienced, brings in this kind of esoteric kind of knowledge. You know, I know that this is God's only true church, and I know that this is, you know, the only path to return to him, those sorts of things that aren't based on any sort of experience. They're just extrapolations. They're two or three steps down the road in this logical chain, or, you know, they're the product of four or five blocks stacked on top of each other.
Right, farther and farther away from the raw, true, powerful experience.
You know, someone's bearing a testimony that, you know, there is a council of gods in heaven, or that, you know, God is a polygamist. Yeah, I mean, you got to follow the logical chain so far down to get to that conclusion that when you apply the word, you know, when you say that you're testifying or you know that that's true, I have a hard time respecting that. I mean, I'll listen to you say it, but I may be reading the New Yorker or something, like I said, in the Post, because it's, you know, I just don't think that person has thought through the distance that they've gone down this logical chain, and I just don't think that language is appropriate way out there on that other end.
You know,
so I guess go ahead, Jana.
I want to point out that one of the things that we haven't really discussed in any detail is the reception of testimonies. What Brent was talking about just now, sitting in the pew, having, you know, the New Yorker open or working on your gospel doctrine lesson or whatever it is you're doing and not listening, which we've all done. And sometimes that's kind of all you can do. But I find that my experience of testimony meeting is so much richer in my home ward than it is when I go, for example, on a business trip and I might stop in a ward and hit a testimony meeting full of perfect strangers, because their testimonies to me sound formulaic and dull and you know, abstract in the way that Brent was talking about, that they're pulling out these esoteric doctrines without context, you know. Whereas in my ward, even if the people don't explicitly refer to the circumstances of their lives, I usually know what's going on and what they're struggling with. And that makes the formula entirely different in my ears. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. If you have totally the context and you know the person.
Right.
Very good. Brian, any quick thoughts on that? Because I think you're right, and I just need to compliment you. I loved your guy when you talked about the guy that's doing the esoteric stuff. You described him as like putting the one elbow on the podium and turning his body.
Right.
The posture of the pontificator was awesome.
You gotta get that down, yeah.
I love that part of your post. So thank you for that. Congratulations on that. So, Brian, some more thoughts?
I did kind of jot down, and I know you're a fan of Fowler too, Dan, but I thought I wrote a note about this, and I think sometimes some of the conflict that happens with people that have a hard time listening to the testimonies and stuff, having kind of gone through doubt and a crisis of faith, that whole kind of issue, I think like the testimony sort of setting where you have this ritual of bearing testimonies and creating the sacred time and space of this meeting. It's very, a lot of times with these common phrases that everybody uses, is very group oriented, kind of like a stage three kind of conventional synthetic faith, you know, where from that perspective, you believe what everybody believes, you know, that's what everybody believes. And what happens is when you get pulled out of that and get into kind of like a more stage four perspective where you have that personal spotlight of truth and everything, you know, you've got this tight beam and everything that's inside your personal spotlight is true and everything outside is not true. And so when those two kind of paradigms meet, you know, somebody up there is talking about their spiritual experience and what that means. And if you've got that personal spotlight, you're like, wait, that's not inside my beam. That's not true. You can't say that up there. You know, that sort of thing. I don't know if anybody else wants to jump into that kind of analysis of what's going on, but that's really what comes to mind a lot of times when I'm thinking about. I catch myself doing it sometimes too, and actually I find that interesting. You know, and that's kind of a neat thing about being challenged listening to people's testimonies sometimes is that if I do start to get irritated, then I can kind of meditate on why am I getting irritated and what does that mean and what's going on in my head and heart and all that stuff.
Exactly. And again, I make this point too often in these podcasts. I think a lot of that irritation sometimes comes with that was me last year. That was me 5 years ago. And those parts of us that are still hanging around and we haven't made peace with an earlier stage of development or whatever. And like you say, Brian, when you catch yourself after, you know, maybe it hadn't happened to you for 6 months, but if it's still happening to you, it's time to look inside and say, wow, what piece of me is this one, you know, grabbing?
Or just appreciate what's going on inside your own heart and soul, you know, and just take a look at it.
Excellent. Well, here's what I want to definitely do two things more for sure. So I want to this idea of how we receive testimonies. I would love each of you to take a moment, whoever's ready first. Great. I kind of pre-prompted you for it. What attitude do you bring when you enter into fast and testimony meeting? What is it that you do that you have found if you, I don't know if you want to call it self-talk or spiritual preparation or whatever, what makes these experiences of, because obviously you're a more complex thinker than the formulaic stuff that you're going to hear. And so knowing that about yourself, what makes these powerful and good lessons for you? What are some attitudes that maybe you bring with you?
I bring a better attitude to fast and testimony meeting than I do the other Sundays, I think, where I'm thinking, oh my gosh, who's going to be speaking today? Ah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because testimony meeting is such a wild card. You never know who's going to get up there. Like Forrest Gump's box of chocolates, you know? But I think that for me, I always learn something. And when I do pray beforehand, which I don't always do, but when I do pray beforehand that there will be some inspiration, and also that, you know, that I can help these people, that I can pray for these people. I think that part of the beauty and the dynamism of testimony meeting is that we are interacting, albeit in a silent way, with whoever is up there bearing a testimony, you know, whether it's praying for that person while they're talking or going up to them afterwards to thank them for their testimony or dropping a plate of cookies by later because they're clearly having a rough time. You know, testimony is this much more interactive aspect of Mormonism than other things.
Wow, that's wonderful. Brian or Brent, either one of you, on sort of when you found yourself having good experiences, did you do some sort of prep or put yourself in a spiritual spot ahead of time that you would like to share?
Well, I guess I would say the frame of mind I try to put myself in is that, I don't know, I actually really enjoy listening to people as they experience their religion. And I even like this outside of Mormonism, but I try to just let myself listen to them, or I try to put myself into an attitude where I can just listen to them and kind of dive into their fish tank, you know, for the 5 minutes that they're up there and feel like I'm just swimming around and it kind of experience whatever it is that they're trying to express up there. I don't know if that makes any sense, but I don't know, like just try to jump into their shoes and feel what they're feeling sort of thing. And it's just, I don't know, I find that kind of interesting. And if I stand in their shoes for just a minute, maybe I will see something also different about myself, you know, just because I'm kind of seeing things from a, I don't know, it just, you know, it kind of challenges my thoughts and feelings.
Terrific. Brent, please, if you got something.
Well, I'm working on having a better attitude. not just fast and testimony meeting, which I've always kind of enjoyed, probably for the same reasons that Jana has. Sounds like some of the same reasons, but just church in general. And I think I've developed some coping mechanisms. I you know, I joke about taking the New Yorker, but I have some other coping mechanisms as well. And one of them, Brian, I think is I like to focus on the experience itself. So, you know, I do enjoy that. I enjoy that in any context when somebody will, you know, tells me in a religious context what they've experienced. I think that's interesting. And I learn a lot from other people. Other people have different experiences and they'll have experiences that I'll probably never have. So, you know, I think there is a lot to be learned there. And then I just have to kind of pull back and recognize that, okay, if I had had that experience, I might interpret it differently and I might draw different conclusions but that's not really my place here. I'm just here to listen to them, and if I don't agree with the conclusion that they've drawn, that's okay. I have to tell myself that. I just have to step back and just say, we're all different. We're going to take these religious experiences and we're going to turn them over in different ways. We're going to hold them up to the light, and we're going to reach different conclusions probably. And that's because we're different people. And so I just have to let that go a little bit. And as I've done that, it's gotten easier and it's gotten better, and I've gotten more out of church.
Terrific.
See, we all sound so compassionate. We all sound like such great Mormons with this. So I feel like I need to follow this up and just say that there are also those testimony meetings where someone gets up and shares some truth that they've just learned from Fox News. And, I'm feeling anything but spiritual. So, it's the full bag. The full.
Well, that's when I pull out the short story.
Yeah,
which I recognize may be rude, but it's my coping mechanism as of late.
True confessions. I always have to bring extra reading material in my church bag. I call them my quiet books, so I don't get disruptive.
Exactly. Absolutely. Now I have to do that more often in Sunday school, I find, than fast and testimony meeting. Even though the church does try to push people, I think anyway, into kind of these decontextualized scripts, up in the kind of the area of explanation or conclusion. At least that's kind of how I like to think about it. People are drawn to experience, and what they want to share are a lot of times are their experiences. And so I think it's interesting, at least it's interesting to me, to see that no matter how much counsel comes down, no matter how many talks are given about, oh, you can only talk about these four things and these are the conclusions that you're supposed to reach and here's your testimony, glove, we still get most of it turns out to be experiences, which is what I value anyway. So,
yeah, and I read a statistic once that said that people remember only 16% of anything we say, and the bulk of what they do remember is stories.
Right.
Dan, can I throw something out there that we might discuss?
Please.
Of personal interest to me. In preparation for this, and I thought about my mission experience. Brian, did you serve a mission?
Yeah, I did. To Germany.
At least for me, it's interesting to look back at that former self. I kind of fantasize about sitting down and having a good conversation with that guy. I'm not sure if that would be positive for either.
read Wayne Booth's spiritual autobiography about his many selves, and he does exactly that. It's fun.
Argue with himself a little bit.
He has a dialogue with his 16-year-old self and his various selves of his life. It's really very well, very profoundly presented.
Huh. Might have to take a look at that. Well, here's my question. Why is there so much emphasis on this idea of a journey, of getting somewhere in terms of faith? We start off, it seems like there's so many metaphors, so many analogies, the stories that we tell, the way we talk about this, it's all framed in terms of this kind of progression and this test. And we're going to start off with this very simplistic faith, and we're going to nurture it, and it's going to grow. And then we're going to get to a point where where we're going to get to that pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. We're going to get to this place of certainty, and we shouldn't stop. I mean, we have to keep moving forward. We got to man up and endure to the end, and we've got to get there. And if it takes us a whole lifetime, then that's great. Why do we set ourselves up with that kind of frame when it comes to spiritual knowledge? That's something I've kind of thought about here over the last little while. I'm not sure that's entirely positive, the more I think about that. But yet we're all conditioned to kind of think that way, that there is this absolute truth out there, and we need to get to it. And we've got these formulas, and we've got these processes that we can apply, whether it's Moroni's Promise or Alma 32 or whatever it is. But we've got to keep pushing forward.
Yeah,
Interesting. Yeah, you actually went somewhere different than I expected with when you started talking about the journey. To me, you know, you're talking really big, and I thought you were going to talk about why are we in such a hurry to think that we're supposed to have arrived by age 18 or 19 or 20 with these "I know" statements. But you're asking the more profound.
I went back to my mission journal. In my mission journals, it's amazing to me to go back and to read some of that, because I struggled with the same issues that I am thinking through now and finally coming to terms with. The seeds are there. I already had some of those issues on my mission.
Oh, yeah, totally.
And so I look back at that and I think, wow, you know, I have this very, it's a couple pages. I hope you don't mind if I'll just take just a second and I'll share it. But there's a couple pages where I write this metaphor or this analogy. And I say, look, I don't know if the church is true or not. I know I'm supposed to know that. This is me, the 19-year-old self, talking. But all I can do is trust the people around me. And what I did in that couple pages is I compared it to a backpack. I said, okay, well, the church is a backpack, and it's heavy. I think something's in there. I've been told I got to carry this thing. You know, I got to pack it over to Spain for 2 years because that's where I've been assigned to serve my mission. And I'm frustrated that I can't open the pack and look inside. I want to know what's in there. In other words, I want to know if the church is true or not. And I went on for a couple pages in my journal there, just talking about the frustration of not being able to get into that backpack and realizing that I might have to carry it for 10 or 20 or 30 years before I would ever really get to know what was inside of it. But yet in that framing is this idea of well, someday I'll get there. So even though I was 19 and I didn't really want to carry that backpack, and I was aware that maybe I didn't really know that the church was true in a literal sense, I still was operating within this framework where I thought, okay, well, I just have to carry this for long enough, and then I'll get to a point where I'll get to open it. And built into that is this real fear and this frustration. You know, I look at this 19-year-old self. And I even frame it this way. I was afraid to put the backpack down because I thought there was a good chance that there was something really valuable in there. So the only alternative I had was to put the backpack on and to carry it. And I look back at that. I don't think that was an entirely positive frame to be operating in a spiritual sense as a 19-year-old. So does the church create that? Do we create that? How does that get there?
I think that the church definitely creates this sense of clear linear progression in the spiritual journey. And very few people's lives actually turn out that way. Even true blue Orthodox Mormons have a lot of issues, that things that happen to them, you know, why did my child have Down syndrome, whatever it is, that make the journey far more complicated. A friend of mine who is a publishing executive started a new imprint at their publishing house, and they called it Formatio, which is about formation, spiritual formation. But for the colophon, the logo on the spine, it was a nautilus, one of those sort of shells, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he was explaining to me something that just clicked, which is that they chose that image because metaphorically you start at one point in the nautilus and you go around and around and you're going deeper each time that you go around. You're not exactly in the same place that you were the last time that you addressed that issue, but
right,
there you are again addressing that issue. And when I think about the spiritual journey in this wonderful image of the nautilus rather than the straight line, it helps me so much. And I hope maybe that would help someone else.
Yeah, and right there, what you said with the Nautilus, Karen Armstrong, the spiral staircase was based upon a T.S. Eliot thing that you're spinning around, but you're at a higher or different level each time you come around, and I think it's terrific. And even the Fowler stages of faith kind of works out that way when you think of every piece, every stage is still part of you. You know, stage two builds upon stage one, and it's essential that stage one was there and that it was a healthy stage and all these different things. And it's like a collapsible drinking cup is a metaphor that Mary Beth Raines brought to the whole idea of that center circle holds water, the second one holds a little more water, the third the, when you raise it to the third ring level, it holds more all the way up, and yet it's a circle, and you're, I don't know, I think I'm kind of blowing this particular analogy, but I love what you just said about taking it from linear to
about it being a spiral
to spiritual. Yeah, and then again, of course, the whole gospel and the scriptures do point to, it isn't something that you acquire with your head. It's something you live into with your being. It's a transformation of character to where, you know, the different truths and knowledge flow into you without compulsory means, and your power flows out of you, just sort of out of a sense of who you are, rather than what you can say as you lean on the pulpit and claim as truth.
Hmm. Although you're still playing into that idea of becoming, of progressing. Just in a different way.
So you see the spiral or the nautilus as just as dangerous as the...
Well, I don't know if it's dangerous or not. I guess my frustration with it is, going back to the backpack analogy, is there any way to look in that backpack?
Well, and then I would just say you are the backpack. You know, there's nothing external that you're carrying. Yeah.
I mean, I'm reminded of Benjamin Franklin. Someone towards the end of his life asked him what he thought about Christianity or Christ, or it was in a letter, I think, and he wrote back and said, "Well, I don't know, but I'm pretty old, and I'm probably going to find out before you. So I'll just leave it at that." That was kind of his response. You know, is there any way out of the cul-de-sac, so to speak? I mean, when you recognize that people across all sorts of different religions, in all sorts of different contexts, have these very same spiritual experiences, and just choose to interpret them in such incredibly diverse ways and reach such incredibly different conclusions, doesn't that take something away from that process a little bit? I mean, it's humbling to me to realize that even if I have all these spiritual experiences, I'm still have to choose what meaning to attach to them. They don't come with that meaning embedded in them, and I have no way of choosing what meaning to assign to them. I'm probably going to assign the meaning that I'm going to grab from the church that I was born into or the culture that I'm born into, but that's just luck, circumstance. I mean, if I were born in India, I would attach different meaning to those experiences. So can you ever get to this place of certainty once you kind of realize what's going on there with the process?
Cool.
No idea.
I don't want to shut down the thinking process by trying to answer that. So leave it out there. Brian, did you have something you were about to say?
Well, I was just going to say, I could probably think of some people that think that they achieve that level of certainty. And so maybe that does happen for people. I feel like I hit that and I shot right past it. but maybe that I kind of know that that's just part of my personality. Like, I love that, you know, both the metaphors you guys just shared. But as soon as you were talking about the backpack and carrying that thing, I thought to myself, oh, I would totally open that backpack.
I wanted to. I just never felt like I could. I can't. I still don't. You know, I mean, if the church, with all the, you know, kind of the way you're supposed to live, everything you're supposed to do, I mean, it can be kind of onerous. So, you know, the backpack analogy still kind of holds for me. Sure, I could do it. I could carry it. But, you know, it's like I want to set it down, you know, explore some paths without it sometimes. And I wish I could, I'm just reminded, let me just throw this out there. Hinckley, when he was being interviewed by Larry King, maybe you guys remember this, but and this kind of ties into to whether or not we can actually look in the backpack or not. But I remember Larry King asking him about revelation. Do you guys remember this?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Larry King says, okay, you're the prophet. And then Hinckley says, well, yeah, I am. And Hinckley says, okay, well, you must receive revelation then. You know, how does it happen? I'm paraphrasing. And then Hinckley says, let me pull it up here. He says, well, it comes in various ways. It's not like I hear a voice or, you know, impressions just come. And then as an example, he says, you know, this very building, and he's talking about the new facilities that were built there in Salt Lake, says there came an impression, a feeling that we needed to enlarge our conferences or our conference center. And I remember listening to that and think, huh, okay, that's it? I mean, is he really talking about the process of revelation? Because I, you know, at least as a missionary, I would have looked at the prophet and thought, well, you know, he's got to have, not only is the backpack open, but, you know, he's got to have the stuff probably displayed on his mantle. I mean, he knows exactly what's in there in a very kind of certain sort of way. But then to hear the prophet in a form like that describe the revelatory process as just impressions or feelings, again, made me kind of reflect on the process. You know, and why is it that we try so hard in the church to get people at least to strive for this certainty that seems to be a little bit of a mirage at the end of the day?
Well, I could throw in, I think there's kind of two things that, that tie into that, like why there's that push for this kind of certainty. And I'm just going to throw this out there, but one thing I think is we make some pretty audacious and outrageous claims. Like, we're not – Mormonism is from its earliest days was saying stuff that's pretty far out there. You know, like, we're going to break convention. We're going to have a prophet now, you know, and – Jesus Christ appears to us, and you know, these are awesome, transcendent, majorly epic kind of things that happen.
Heroic it's, assertions. Yeah,
heroic assertions. And so it's like you can't really say, well, yeah, but you know, it's maybe that's possibly true. You know, it's like say something this huge and heroic and then kind of, you know, back away from it sort of thing. But I'm not saying that to be cynical. I'm saying that there's a power in that, in making those kind of claims. And the second thing is I think we have this really deep longing for a clear, ideal universe where there's a God that is actually concerned about us. Like God and Satan care enough to have a war over me as an individual. You know, these great gods and great beings, and that the God has a plan and everything in my life has meaning. I think these are really powerful ideas, and they get power with pushing for this certainty that these things are true. Mm-hmm. Does that make any sense? Like, even though I know that, you know, I could admit all these things are not even close to provable in a sense where, you know, epistemology of, you know, the sense of knowing, but it's just sort of living these kind of epic. We have to have a story for our life, and Mormonism has this heroic story, and it's not as powerful if you just think, well, yeah, maybe that could be true.
Right, right, yeah, no, I definitely agree.
Very interesting. Joanna, did you have any quick thoughts? I do want to steer us, I think, three more spots. So, but anything on Brent's comments about arrival and stuff beyond the Nautilus analogy and those insights?
I don't have an answer for Brent about this question of destination. I think that it's certainly something that the church emphasizes. You know, the goal is to be reunited with Heavenly Father, to live with your eternal family, etc. And that's the end goal. Spiritual formation, when it's genuine, is so much more complex than that and involves repeated regression. that's something that we never talk about, how regression is an important part of progress. But I wanted to say, Brian, I really liked what you just said about how Mormonism makes particularly audacious claims. You know, it's not just that we are saying, oh, I believe in puppies. You know, I know that puppies are true. This is really outrageous stuff.
Yeah, we're going to be, well, I don't want to get into all the deep doctrine stuff, but you know what I'm saying. We make outrageous claims.
Right, we do. And universal, I mean, these aren't, I mean, these are kind of heroically expansive claims about not only, I mean, this is about all of humanity, and, you know, everybody that's ever lived and is going to live on this planet is going to a certain place. You know, we're all on this certain journey. So, I mean, our theology is all-encompassing in that respect.
Well, cool. And that go ahead, please.
Just wanted to add to Brent's story about President Hinckley and Larry King. You know, when the Nauvoo Temple was dedicated, I attended the temple dedication by satellite in my home ward. And President Hinckley made some comment about how he felt the spiritual presence of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young and some of the other early leaders of the church. And it was, you know, in the same way that we might feel the spirits of our ancestors or something like that. And afterwards, I walked out to the foyer, and this guy in my ward was just so excited because President Hinckley had seen a vision of Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. So despite everyone's best efforts,
something about
Mormon prophet, they want the prophet to be having these exceptional experiences that are not the same as what ordinary rank and file Mormons have.
And we do have all these, you know, as a missionary, you hear all these things, rumors about, you know, calling an election made sure and, you know, different, you know, we do want some sort of end game there. I mean, we want some sort of conclusion to this journey that we're on. And I think we do want people to have gotten to the end. So we do want the prophet to, you know, to see visions and have these miraculous experiences.
I'll have to engage you on the blog a bit, Brent, because I've got, I actually prefer the quiet voice and just a person who's learned to trust those impressions through years and years of practice. So I like the fact that he answered it that way. It, you know, it closes the distance a bit, but yet I still recognize the, you know, decades and decades and decades of somebody who's humbled himself and has tried to recognize those things. And then on the question of the destination issue, I'd probably push you a little bit more along like the Maslow hierarchy or something, where at a certain point, you know, your motivations change. And I think instead of, you know, reward based, you know, here's the end goal, I think there comes a point where you self-direct and you self-choose, and this idea of the church saying this is where you're headed becomes something that you just have lived into naturally. And you know, the whole thing is about relationality, and every relationship is a risk. Every relationship with a new person does not have the end written from the beginning. And that the same thing goes with getting in there in that nice spiritual wrestle with God. You don't know what's going to happen, but you know there's a blessing at the end of it, and so you're in it, but you really don't see the end from the beginning. And so I see what you're saying, but I think at a certain point, you know, even if you say, you know, the without compulsory means stuff still means that there's an end in sight, I do think it happens just naturally from within rather than, you know, that external story that says it. So anyway, those would be areas that we can fight it out, not fight it out, but draw each other out deeper. I want to do a couple things. There was one piece of testimony that one of you said just draw me to, and that's the ultimate conclusion is not only is I know the church is true, but I know the church is the one and only true church. And we start to add this level of exclusivity, or I think it was you, Brent, that maybe said something that's the entire world has to end up eventually seeing it our way or recognizing these truths kind of thing. I know that's one of the biggest pieces in the blogging community when people react negatively to testimony. How do you all handle that when you hear one and only true?
I don't agree with it. How's that?
I don't agree with it either.
Nah.
Sorry.
Conversation stopper, huh?
Well, I think here's my problem with that. It built into our doctrine is this idea that we have unique access to God. And that's built right into, you know, the way missionaries explain baptism. I mean, you're supposed to get baptized so you can get the gift of the Holy Ghost. So you have this, you know, unique connection to the Holy Ghost. Which is going to kind of, you know, put you in the front of the bus, so to speak. And then you're going to have that stronger connection. You're going to have spiritual experiences that are stronger and more valid in a way. And that everyone kind of has to converge on that same model. I think once you grow up a little bit, though, and you start realizing that people across all different faiths have profound, life-changing spiritual experiences that for them, in many cases, confirm the validity of their own spiritual path, you have to kind of give up on the one true kind of assertion there, because it kind of bumps up against reality. And either you've got to start discounting what these other people are telling you and discounting their spiritual experiences and saying, well, ours are more valid, or you just have to say, look, you know, I really know what's going on here. You know, I'm on my path here, and they appear to be doing fine on their path, and I guess we just got to kind of live and let live. At least that's kind of how I come down on it.
Brian, any thoughts on that one? Oh, go ahead.
My husband is making me laugh here. He pumped his fist in the air when you were talking, Brent, about how people in other religions have legitimate spiritual experiences.
Well, believe it or not, what I'm surprised by is that assertion would get me in trouble with a lot of people at church. The reason I know that is because I have gotten in trouble.
But by saying no one and only true?
Well, in priesthood meeting, we went down this path, and it was fascinating to see how it broke down, because it was about half and half, with half the people in that meeting saying, well, you know, I'm unwilling to say that our spiritual experiences are more valid than other people, you know, that have in other faiths. And the other half of the class, and, you know, these are high priests, so, you know, these are people that have been around the block a little bit. The other half was very disturbed by what we were saying, because they were coming down on the, well, wait a second, you know, we believe that we all have the gift of the Holy Ghost, and we believe that this is the one and only true church. So what you're saying contradicts with that belief. And, you know, we didn't get to the bottom of it. The instructor probably wisely steered us in another direction. But it was interesting to me to kind of see how that broke down.
Very interesting. All right, guys, I'd like to steer us home with, I really appreciate this. You guys have been fantastic, and this has gone in fun and interesting directions, and directions that I want to ponder more and engage you more on the blog about. But there's one final area that I prompted you a little bit about in our prep ahead of time, and I hope that each of you'd be willing to share something. When you do participate in Fast and Testimony reading as more than a listener, or when you have a chance in a class or something, how is it that you bear your testimony? Because my guess is all of you know that it's probably not a good idea to get up there and bear something really radical and different, because that just calls attention, you know, away from what the whole purpose of things is. It focuses on you and your differences and things like that. And my guess is when we bear our testimonies, we want to still contribute to the community life. So what are some of the phrases or some of the things that you testify about versus things that maybe you leave out or whatever that might be things for listeners to chew on as they do this sort of same thing?
I can go first. Yes, I do bear my testimony from time to time. It's a great privilege to do that. I think my approach is a little bit different. I think, like I said at the beginning, I've never heard of this whole testimony glove thing. My approach is to choose an experience that has helped me understand one particular aspect of doctrine or the gospel or faith, and only talk about that thing. For example, in October, one of my friends from high school committed suicide, and it was quite devastating to learn that, and I was reflecting quite a bit on the idea of him having the opportunity to continue to make spiritual choices that would affect his eternal destiny, and what a comfort that was to me. So, you know, that was a very specific doctrine that I wanted to focus on. I wasn't talking about, you know, the whole church is true and you know, rainbows and unicorns. I think if we could do that, focus on one thing, it would be helpful. The other thing that I try to do is to not aggrandize my language. If I don't absolutely know something, I don't say that I know something. I say that I believe or that I hope to believe. And I think that's a good approach.
Great. Terrific. Brian?
Yeah, I guess, let's see. I think for a long time, even before I knew so much or had thought, spent a lot of time thinking about why I was uncomfortable with just with the phrase, the church is true. I know for quite a while I would say something more along the lines of the gospel being true, because I felt more comfortable with that. And I would say I could still say something like that today, but that's because in my mind, the definition of the gospel to me is all things that are true. So, I mean, it's sort of like a circular thing to say that the gospel is true. But, you know, I'm not so comfortable with all those formulaic phrases anymore. So I tend not to say those things. I will say things like, you know, I believe in the message of such and such, you know, and talk about, you know, an experience I've had with something, or I'm comfortable saying that I've experienced the transformative nature of the gospel, and maybe talking, like Jana was saying, you know, talking about something that I had experienced. I mean, I suppose I could say, well, I know this is true, but I'm not really comfortable saying that anymore. But instead, I could say, I have experienced such and such. I don't know. I mean, I feel like having participated in Mormonism has transformed me in ways that I like, you know, that I think it's done good things for me. So, you know, I mean, that's something I could say. Also, you know, using language like I have faith in the broad purposes of the church. So anyways, that's the kind of language that I use. And I don't really so much formally stand up much and say that I testify of this and I testify of that. I just kind of like sharing, you know, some of the experiences from my journey.
Terrific. Thank you. Brent?
Yeah, you know, I've lately have thought that that I would like to participate, but I'm still a little unsure how to do that. I've thought about it, and I think I could get up and maybe relate a spiritual experience that I've had. I think that would be okay. Probably keep myself from getting into too much trouble with that, but. The problem with that is I'm not sure I would be able to provide any sort of honest explanation or any sort of conclusion on top of that that would really be acceptable or that would contribute to the group. So I guess I don't. That keeps me from participating.
So you're talking about you like phase one and two. You don't like three right. And four, but you're worried that you're not going to go to a three and a four.
Heather and I were at a public school event not long ago, and it was just a silly thing they had there in the cafeteria, and they were giving out some awards, and there were some things that were said, and watching some of the other parents, how they interacted with their children, just really kind of touched both of us. And so Heather leaned over to me and said, "Hey, you know, I know this school is true." Just kind of recognizing that we were kind of having a spiritual experience there. So I thought about that. I'm like, well, yeah, I mean, that was a very moving kind of spiritual experience to just see the parents interacting with kids in such a positive way and to see the teachers that cared so much about those kids. And so I would like to share that, but I'm not sure what gospel conclusion I can kind of, I guess that's where I hesitate. I think eventually I will find a way to kind of contribute in a way that won't be disruptive and won't challenge other people, but will still kind of, I guess I would like to be included in the group a little bit. So I'm still kind of working through that.
I really appreciate your honesty there. That was terrific. And look forward to hearing a report if and ever it happens.
So see if I come up with something.
Cool. Yeah. Hey, well, thanks everybody. Is there anything that anyone had to share tonight that they brought to it that I didn't allow or steer us in the right direction to get in?
No, sounds good.
Well, thank you. You guys have been terrific. Jana, I know you've joined us after being sick and just barely getting your voice back, so an extra thanks to you. Plus, you're back on the East Coast with Brian, so you guys are up pretty late. So thank you especially to you. And Brent, thank you for the great post that prompted this, and we hope all of our listeners will visit the blog and will engage each other as well as engage those of us here on the panel. I'll encourage everyone to visit, and thank you very much for being part of this tonight.
Yeah, thanks. It was great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
Do this. All is well.